You're listening to Panel Borders on Resonance 104.4 FM. I'm Alex Fitch, and continuing this month's series of shows about war comics, we have another panel discussion recorded at the Imperial War Museum's Comics and Conflicts Conference, which took place in August 2011. In today's episode, we have the recording of a panel called The Personal and the Political, in which I talk to publisher and artist Sean Duffield, and cartoonists Daniel Locke and Ben Naylor, who all contributed to the book-length collection War, The Human Cost. Also joining us on the panel are Francesca and Eileen Cassavetti. Francesca republished her mother's wartime diary, Philip and Helena, in comic book format, so the panel is a celebration of self-publishing unusual war stories that probably wouldn't get seen in war comic books anywhere else. Before that, here's a word from our sponsors.
Resonance FM is London's only non-profit community radio art station, who need your donations to help keep the station and podcasts on air. All the program makers and all the engineers all work for free to bring you shows as diverse as The Bike Show, The Free University of the Airways, Hooting Yard, Speakers Resonance Corner, FM accepts donations in the form of cheques, credit and debit cards, radio, bank transfers, PayPal and cash. Go to www.resonancefm.com for more details. We also accept hobnobs and teabags. Your donation means our continued existence.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the second panel of the day. We're looking at self-publishing to a certain extent, in that we have Ben Naylor, Sean Duffield and Daniel Locke from War, The Human Cost, a new anthology which is helping the campaign against the arms trade.
It sort of raises awareness for Amnesty International and a few of the charities.
Sean, could you talk a little about the genesis of the project, when you knew that you wanted to do this collection and bring in a variety of different artists in order to, you know, give their thoughts about what war means to them and why, you know, we need to alert more people about the constant suffering around the world?
I think it was born from a kind of mixture of feeling quite frustrated and a little bit angry. Just about the kind of I've been sort of interested in kind of politics and I've kind of like spoke to a lot of people who've had some kind of direct involvement around war, whether that be they were involved in some kind of charity or that was basically going over to a country and dealing with what happens, or there's a couple of people I know who've been in conflict, but also the kind of I live in Brighton. I moved there about 11 years ago, and one of the things I love about it is there's a kind of a lot of people there who encourage alternative media. And they encourage forums where people can speak in a different way than we get on mainstream media, which is predominantly soundbite. And issues are dealt with very kind of piecemeal, with not much debate, or if there is debate, very extreme, one extreme and another, and not a kind of a chance where people who kind of know what they're talking about get to convey what was happening. So at the time, there was a heck of a lot of propaganda. It was still, I believe, Tony Blair and George Bush were still in power when I started the book. And I kind of wanted something that brought together, like this talk says, the personal and the political, really, that tried to bring together all these different issues regarding war, whether that be the business of war, which is, to some people, it's a very profitable venture and has been for a long time, and they will do everything to kind of keep these kind of things going and make sure that their interests are listened to by politicians, and that politicians basically make concessions for them by subsidizing their companies, and also, you know, making sure that a lot of money goes on military spending. But I wanted to deal with kind of people's experiences, whether soldiers or civilians from different countries. And when I started off, I realised there was people like Dan and Ben who I knew or contacted, and they were very keen to be a part of the project. But I thought, wouldn't it be good if we could get people from different countries to talk about their experiences rather than getting things through a very Western kind of perspective? Let's hear the voices which are generally excluded. And let's get the kind of stories of people who have survived war, whether, you know, soldiers who have survived war or refugees and asylum seekers. And in a roundabout way, it kind of involves people who work with the after effects of war, try to prevent it as well, but it's not a kind of dry kind of like a campaign, this is what our manifesto is. It's rather the stories which incorporate where these groups got involved. So that was kind of the genesis of it, and it kind of grew from there, and ended up being from artists from 19 countries getting involved and getting a very broad kind of sense of a lot of contemporary issues regarding conflicts and the aftermaths. Also exposing the kind of corruption and the kind of what you see on the public platform and what actually goes on behind the scenes. But also looking historically as well. So you've got, so, you know, the present context, and what Helena was talking about is, like, you know, that since her direct experience in World War II, there's been this kind of perpetual warmongering. And that, you know, when you get a lot of these stories from the past, it makes the present a lot clearer. And that was basically the aim of the book, and I think it worked okay in the end. I was quite proud with the results. Mm. It grew a lot as well. It was supposedly going to be 200 pages initially, and it grew to 260 because I just thought there's no way you can deal with so much stuff in 100 pages.
Well, if we could talk about some of your individual contributions to the book. Ben, we've got your story, an AK-47 tale here. What was the genesis of your contribution? Was it based on a particular story that you'd read in the media that you wanted to retell about, you know, a soldier's experience, or something just more basic than that?
That great sort of artistic standby of last minute desperation, because after the first two things that I submitted to Sean were cruelly rejected by him, I'm sure he'll mention this later. I mean, it took a very long time to get the book done from when he proposed it to when it actually came out. You know, he's really been working hard on it for years. Was it 4 years? Is it
about 4.5? Yeah.
All right.
We changed prime ministers in between.
Which was good. Yeah, it played a part in that, I think. We wrought this incredible change on the world. But when it started, I mean, there's obviously been many deadlines, and they just kept sort of getting pushed back. So I was just desperately scrabbling around for something to submit for it, and just trying to come up with something, because the deadline is then, but then, you know, it sort of gradually moved back. Nothing really sort of sparked it off. I'm not an expert on guns, but I knew that the AK-47 was a very popular one, and it was well made, and I just thought, well, you know, what if you were one of these guns, and you had some kind of consciousness? I mean, the idea of writing a story from the point of view of an object isn't in any way new, of course. But I thought, what if you were an AK-47? You were a bit fed up with your lot in life, and you wanted to try something different. You know, but there's not really much else you can do. So that was it, really. So, yeah.
And Dan, your story of a fisherman's memoirs. Was that someone that you encountered in Brighton whose story that you wanted to tell?
Yeah, I first met George when I was 19, working as a KP in my family's tea shop. And I remember one Saturday, I was working as the pot wash in the back of the shop, cleaning all the dishes, and George came in and all of a sudden told me this story. and it was really busy, and I was trying to listen while cleaning the plates and stuff, but I never really forgot it. And then when the opportunity came up from Sean to contribute something to this book, I thought this is the ideal story. He was an amazing, you know, he was an amazing guy, lived a really interesting life, and was full of incredible stories. This was just the one that was most suitable.
And did you have to do much research in terms of rendering the ships?
Unfortunately, by the time the book came around, George passed away. So I spoke to his son, and I also found out the ship that he served on, and sort of fudged some of the details otherwise. The main thing was to get across the emotional sort of content of the story. I don't really know why he was locked down in the armory. He never made that clear to me, or the magazine. He never made that clear to me, and I don't know why someone would be down there. So I don't know how the ship works, but you know, that's what happened.
It was a lot of time, wasn't he? He was locked in with all his explosives.
He was down there for 12 hours, apparently, while it was all going on upstairs.
In a way, this kind of links back to Eileen's story now being available to a whole new generation of readers. And in fact, I mean, not that it was available before, the fact that Francesca has kind of delivered this story to a wider audience means that your story can now be shared with the young generation the same way that Dan has retold this story in print. In your experience as a historian, do you find that these kind of personal stories connect better with people if they have this ring of autobiography to them?
Yes, I suppose they do. Yeah.
Because, for example, seeing your diary, it also has that authenticity of an original document. It not only is you writing it, but also the little illustrations that you contribute to the text are obviously evocative of the time, and it's the way that you saw events filtered through your memories and through your penmanship. I mean, was it important to include the illustrations rather than just text?
Well, I never thought of it without illustrations. It was part of the story. And what is so important in it is it's got nearly all the important things Philip said, and which are true. And although, you know, the plane was shot down, came down in the sea, and all on board were lost, but, as I said before, once you've said these things and conveyed them to another person, they're not lost.
Yeah.
They go on. Mm. And this is, I suppose, the positive side of otherwise desperate things that happen, that you just, you know, you think you can't go on living, but you can, and you have to.
Definitely.
But there is more to it than that, because of all the detail. You're someone who records every detail of things. You always do, in letters, in everything.
You know what we had to eat and
all
that kind of thing.
You will write down every, what you ate, what you read, and that's what makes it even more kind of vibrant and real, because it paints a picture of the whole thing, and it fills in a lot of background.
Yeah, it wasn't a diary. It was simply a record that I had to put down so that it wasn't lost immediately.
Yeah.
And while I was writing it and while I was drawing the little pictures, it helped me so much, you know, that this was something that was real, and that thousands more people had gone through the same thing, like me.
And Dan, when it came to you retelling this story, I mean, obviously it was quite time-sensitive as well, because like you said, you know, he's no longer there to tell the story. Yeah. That journalistic impulse that you had to take on, did you find that very fulfilling, bringing this guy's story to a wider audience, and has it inspired you to do more works like that?
Yeah, since then I have done more work, but it's really difficult and challenging, and also puts you in a really difficult position. Of where do I sit in the retelling of this story, and what right do I have to do it? But the fact that the stories are so compelling, and so they communicate something so important about an experience which is so far away from my own experience of in my life, but something which is going on right now, You feel like, oh, this has got to be done. Because otherwise, George is just one of like thousands in the Second World War that would have lived, millions that lived these sort of horror stories. And this was just like one instance in his experience of the war. There were other stories he told me. And so it's sort of unimportant in a way. There's so many of them, but it's so important and so worth retelling.
There was when I was posted to London to the WAF Directorate, it was to the public relations section, and that meant that they sent me round stations, England and Scotland, radar stations, lonely stations, to see what the WAF were doing.
Yeah.
And one of these was on Orkney at Scapa Flow, and this was in June after the dreadful Christmas when Philip was lost. And I got to Scapa Flow, and that's where the aircraft carrier Ark Royal had been sunk by German submarines.
Yes.
And on the shore, walking along this lonely shore by the Nissen Huts, that was the radar station, I came across the scrap of a letter from one of the people who'd been on board, describing, you know, what the sort of training in the Navy was and all the rest of it. And I've still got this letter, which I put in my scrapbook. But this was another instance of just war and how it affected individual people all over the world in different ways, and goes on. But it's something material that's there, and therefore, well, as long as it lasts.
Indeed.
But it's a sort of testimony to what people went through.
Yes. Yeah. Sean, if we could move on to a very different kind of story. Your tale, Liberation in Liberia, I guess is an example of one of the war stories that doesn't get told quite so often. I mean, you know, we're in the Imperial War Museum today, and you come into the atrium and you see the massive tanks and the planes, which are kind of classic warfare. And the kind of tales that that Ben and Eileen have relayed in this kind of format are also something that you can get in the War Museum's collection in terms of letters and interviews with people who fought in war, which are very well facilitated by the AV department copying them, I must say, on a regular basis. But in terms of the other kind of stories that maybe are more political, I guess that was the sort of thing that, you know, influenced your decision to retell this story.
Because it's a civil war as well. You know, a lot of wars are fought in very different ways, and it starts off quite a bleak story. One of the reasons I chose, I didn't get a chance to do all the stories that I'd like to, that I wanted to do myself. And
volume 2.
I don't think so. Not in a while, anyway. It's a bit of a struggle. But I think one of the things was that obviously it's ongoing, and the way the story ends is there's an uncertainty. But I thought this was quite a positive story of people, predominantly women, who had been through a heck of a lot for, I think, over a decade in the Civil War, which started off with Charles Taylor rising to power. And this guy was basically sold off all the country's assets. He'd made a lot of money through Sierra Leone, through blood diamonds, and was basically ruling as a dictator and butchering people. He was recruiting child soldiers and giving them drugs and encouraging them to go out basically and kill and rape and you know, just run amok, so people were afraid of him. And what happened was there's this kind of weird religious kind of tribalism as well, because Charles Taylor was a Christian, and a lot of the rebels who came about were Muslim. Mm. So the men had this very kind of tribal thing going on, and the rebels, you know, we're no better really than what Charles Taylor was doing. We're doing the same things, getting child soldiers and getting them to fight and do the same things. And in the middle was the kind of innocent people and the mothers and the children. And there's some horrendous accounts of rape and children, you know, being basically told to shoot the parents and to join these kind of groups. Although others were kind of more seduced into it. And basically, then what happened was the women got together. It started from this woman called Lema, who had a kind of dream when one night of bringing all the women in her church together, all the Christian women, to come out in peaceful protest. And what happened, one of the early talks she gave to the church about getting everybody together was there's a Muslim woman who'd heard that she was, you know, talking about this very passionately. And she turned up and was very moved, and she actually got on the mic at the front of the church and said, "I'm going to talk to all my sisters in the church. We agree what you're doing." So basically, where the men were fighting this kind of, not, it wasn't a religious war, but that had a factor in it. The women came together and said, we want enough of this. We want to, you know, we've been through so much. And they all wore white, and they all were protesting on a daily basis in various camps, the main one being near the capital of Monrovia. And it was. I can only imagine how scary it was, because, you know, I only know about this through kind of second-hand accounts, but they weren't sure whether they were just going to be killed. Like, you know, Charles Taylor was known to just kill his enemies, and they'd had sort of kind of warnings as such to stay off the streets, kind of veiled threats, and they carried on, and it grew. And there's lots of very clever kind of non-violent and non-kind of finger-pointing tactics, where they made it about what they were protesting against, what affected them, rather than saying, "We don't like this government, we don't like the rebels." They fought a very successful campaign, basically, and it became known a lot. The West kind of eventually got involved, but only to a small degree. And it was at these peace talks where it came to a point where Lema was, they were asking to remove the women. The women had surrounded the peace talks, and they basically were asking her to remove her troops. They said there's been a takeover, and they're trying to make out as though she was some kind of militia or junta or something. And so basically, she was really upset because they'd worked so hard, and they didn't want, these peace talks were becoming a joke. It was just Charles Taylor saying, "I will fight to my last breath," and the rebels basically saying, "We want, you know," they were beginning to win this war, and they were saying, "Right, well, what cushy kind of parliament job are we going to get?" And this was the last push, basically. This was the last hope of achieving some peace. And there was a kind of turning point, really, where it's sort of this kind of, from what I believe, there was a kind of this kind of matriarchal power came into place. And I won't go on too long, but basically things changed. The UN came in. They made a deal for peace, and it's been very shaky since. They've got the first African female president. He's President Sirleaf, and they've been making headway, but then the banking crisis happened. There's a lot of rebuilding to do, so a lot of these kind of old militia people are still got a lot of weapons, and they're still threatening to kind of start things off again. So at the moment things are very unsure, but it seems to be that the women are very dedicated to trying to maintain the peace. So basically that's what the story was about. It was about a kind of peaceful, non-violent resistance where women got together from, you know, different sides of the tracks.
The last 2 days in general obviously have been about how war comics can tell all sorts of different stories. You know, the forgotten narratives on a personal level, the more political stories that you guys have dealt with. What do you think it is about comics that tells these kind of stories perhaps in a better way than other media, than just text without images, than film perhaps, which can be, you know, jingoistic. I don't know if you want to start with you, Ben, and move this way.
Well, I mean, there's the old saying, the picture's worth a thousand words. You can just convey an enormous amount of information to me instantly in a picture. You can just convey a sense of a place or how things are affecting people in that place very effectively in a comic, and then you combine words as well, so you're going to get even more information across. I think it's quite an easy and powerful way of conveying information and conveying emotion. I mean, obviously you can describe in some text about how someone's feeling about a terrible situation or something like that, but if you can draw a picture of their face as well and you've got some sort of text to back it up, I just think it's just a powerful way of getting information across, really.
I think it is a really powerful medium, you know, like as Ben said, it combines the words and the pictures and stuff, but it's not especially powerful. You know, film can do as well, prose can do as well, poetry, and there are examples of those across history. It's just that this is, although it's got a long history, comics, it's also a very young medium and hasn't been utilised or exploited in the way that other mediums have or other modes of expression have. So, you know, I think comics are brilliant, and the war comic is a brilliant example of what comics can do and the diverse voices that can be expressed through that medium. And I look forward to reading this book because this seems amazing, which isn't exactly a comic,
no.
But you know, it shows how broad comics are as well. If you want to call it a comic, then
but if you're trying to interest younger people in these sorts of stories, then comics is a good way to go, because you know, if you present a book or a talk, you know, comics they have that reputation, particularly in this country. As I mentioned earlier, France is. They're much more in the mainstream, and they're not sort of looked down upon, but they are sort of looked down upon a little bit in this country as being for kids. But you can take advantage of that and get these kind of stories across to kids because it's in a comic form. So they go, oh, it's a book. No, oh, it's a comic. Cool. You know, it's got pictures. That's a positive aspect, I think, about comics, that you can kind of... Although most comic people in this country will spend ages railing against the fact that comics are considered kids stuff, you know.
I think maybe it
comes in handy sometimes.
Yeah. Mm. It's really ironic that comics are considered kids stuff in this country, because kids don't read comics in this country anymore. So, you know, it's us. Do. We're the people that read comics, I think.
It's people the 2000 AD generation.
Yeah. I think it's important and healthy with any kind of... art medium is to have a range, you know, and if the more people think comics are just super, you know, kind of Marvel or DC, which they've maybe been introduced to, and for children, then it's a kind of arrested development. So the more people are bringing out comics, and I think, you know, people recognize a lot of the big kind of successful kind of graphic novels, but it'd be, you know, I think part of the reason, I mean, I love comics, I have since I was a child, and I've always wanted to do them. I enjoy writing, and I've tried, you know, painting, and I enjoyed that, but I found it a good tool for storytelling, because it does combine the visual and the kind of written word. And, you know, I'd love to be a filmmaker, but I couldn't afford to do it. It was, you know, pretty hard getting the funding for the book, but managed. But it's a lot easier to do something. It's an accessible medium, you know. I think that's, like Dan said, I don't think it's any more important than any other media. But I think it's nice to see things explored.
Although perhaps in an artist doing research, such as, for example, Joe Cahoon's artwork, which we can see on the wall from Charlie's Wall. He went to photographs of the Battle of the Somme, and in certain cases reproduced exactly what you could have seen at the time, but in a sense with greater fidelity, because, as was mentioned yesterday, some of those photos are quite murky, and yet his artwork is more detailed. And then that's combined with the emotion that you can get as an artist in perhaps telling these kind of stories that is lost with $100 million Hollywood production that can perhaps recreate perfectly the battlefields of France, but something is lost in the budget and the committee and the CGI.
But I think, the heart's not there.
That's really true. But also, remember, most comics are set. Most comics produced in English, at least, are set about glorifying war, aren't they? So, you know, it depends. It's all to do with the motivation and the purpose of the artist, really, I think, fundamentally. And, you know, it can be detail. I mean, this is great. Charlie's War is fantastic and sort of obviously a really important work, but detail for me doesn't necessarily come into it. It's sort of emotional integrity and the story that's told that's important.
But then you look at somebody like Joe Sacco, you know, you look at the detail. You've got a combination of all those different things and a journalistic kind of take on things.
Definitely,
you know?
Those are great books.
Yeah,
but my point is stick men can do as good. Do you know what I mean?
I don't think any medium is necessarily more suited.
No.
Subject comics. Matter. Yeah. I mean, there are great war films.
Yeah, there are.
You know,
great
quite
war films
on
are
the
great.
Western Front. Or
exactly.
Johnny Got His Gun. There are some fantastic anti-war films. And
I use comics because I love comics.
Yeah.
And I want
because
to make
it happens
comics.
To be the medium that we work in.
Yeah.
That comes naturally to
I
us.
Think,
and
I think
also,
none of us are
the matter
rich
of budget.
Either.
Yeah. comes into it. It's a very cheap medium.
That is something that's really important about comics.
And a very portable medium.
Yeah. It is a really accessible medium, and anyone can. And make a comic.
Yeah.
Like my daughter's 18 months old, she's made her first comic already.
Yeah.
So it's a really, really accessible medium.
Mm.
Well, I mean, Eileen, what's your take on the fact that a young generation will be able to pick up your diary now in a place where comics and art books are sold and engage with it in a way that perhaps, you know, watching a movie or reading a book would tell that story in a very different way?
I don't really know what to say about that. I really don't. Because, I don't belong to this age of technology. It's sort of beyond me. I feel I'm just so old-fashioned and so forth, so I can't really think of the reaction of people who know all about these things back to a very simple story like this, which just happened to be true.
Well, I mean, I think it's the authenticity, in a way, that's the most important thing.
Yeah. But it's just that the technology is here that I was able to scan it and reproduce it, because that's all that's happened. There must be lots of things like this around that never get seen, because...
Well,
people
thanks to the
them.
Imperial War Museum. we've only got a short amount of time, but if anyone in the audience has any questions for anyone on the panel, any short questions, then there is a roving microphone.
I'm very conscious of the fact that every time I go into a cafe for a bacon sarnie or something, for the last God knows how long, I've got images, usually in the tabloids, of our heroes doing this and our heroes doing that and our this, that and the others, yeah? Until I can hardly look at the word hero anymore. And I think it's significant that the one genre that puts me off is also the dominant one, the superhero one. I would always aim for the graphic novel underground section and avoid all these guys with their underpants on outside their trousers, you know? So what is it about the how can we de-heroize? Simply by joining an outfit. I mean, it's slightly different. I mean, it's very different, I think, from what Helena's talking about, where it was a war for survival against something very nasty, and even pacifists were forced often to get up and fight. That's slightly different to volunteering for adventures, more or less, where nobody's forcing you. Anything that can debunk that heroic nonsense is important for this world, and it also takes the kind of glamour away from the arms people a bit as well, you know, with their equipment fetishes.
The word hero is actually it's dehumanizing, isn't it? Because it takes away the individual's experience of you know, often although they may act like courageously or bravely, it might be a traumatic event in their lives. Yeah, exactly, yeah. And so, I couldn't agree more. It's a horrible thing.
It's kind of the definition of the word as well, what heroic is. I mean, it seems to be it's used in the real world. There's the superhero thing, and then there's like the real world, and it always tends to be kind of alpha male, go out there, you know, might is right kind of thing. To my mind, if you know, yeah, like Dan said, you know, it's a word, and you shouldn't really just like label somebody as a heroic or non-heroic, but surely people do things in their life which could be deemed as heroic, which are not a kind of war-based, or kind of like where you've got a clash with somebody, or just being able to have the bravery to stand up as a voice of dissent when somebody's trying to orchestrate this kind of mass patriotism or kind of propaganda, I think is quite, it takes courage. And to me, my understanding of the word heroic is to have courage. And but yeah, it's not something you see. A lot of people tend to be attacked for trying to create a kind of middle way and trying to avoid these kind of very black and white responses to things. And yeah, I think, you know, it's a shame that the a lot of the tabloid journalism really kind of makes these things very oversimplistic.
I'd say surely the value of stories like Eileen's and stories like, what was the fishmonger's name?
George Watts.
George. The value in them lies in that you're returning the story of war to the individual.
Yeah.
You're returning the fact that everyday actions were moments of bravery. And they were like, it's the story of every man. And one of our problems in the modern world is that we've become so divorced from war. We've become so divorced from the reality that our young working class people who, in the whole, are serving soldiers, sailors, airmen of the lower ranks, will come from working class communities in the more deprived parts of our country. And it's a job. It's a way out. It's a way to establish some personal responsibility and some personal advancement. And our officer classes tend to come from traditional officer classes, which I don't deny their right to do that. Where the problem lies in our modern society is that the likes of Kelvin McKenzie and Rupert Murdoch and Rebecca Wade, those kind of filth, take this story and make it something that it's not. They take away the individual moments of bravery, the individual expression of the human spirit, and make it into this big banging gong, which they will bang while they sit at expensive dinner tables in restaurants. I don't mean to sound like Citizen Smith, but what I'm trying to say here is that the story of war is actually the story of individuals, the story of people who stand up for something that they believe to be right.
The things I found memorable about George's story is that it was a battle missed for him. He spent it locked away in a room, but he was nonetheless brave for just being there, you know, and just actually sort of surviving it.
And doing his job, exactly. Loading shells onto lifts, which take them up to the gun turrets.
Yeah, right.
Just like a WAF person serving on an airfield happened to sort of quite often, you know, help with pull dead men out of bombers.
Yep.
You know, we have the kind of the joy of standing back.
Anyway, I'm afraid we've kind of run out of time. I'd like to thank Ben, Dan, Sean, Francesca and Eileen for their contribution to this panel.
If you'd like to hear some additional footage that I recorded on stage with Eileen and Francesca Cassavetti, please listen to this month's Ladies Do Comics podcast, which you can find at www.ladiesdopodcasts.wordpress.com, and that's spelt LadiesDopodcasts. And the podcast will be going online towards the end of this month. An earlier conversation between me and the Cassavetes, along with event organisers Paul Gravett and Ariel Kahn, is also available at www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Self-published comics are celebrated throughout London this month, with an exhibition at Flashback Records, 144 Crouch Hill, London N8, in which We Are Words and Pictures are presenting an exhibition of comics and illustration about music. Artists contributing include Adam Cadwell, John Douglas, Julia Scheel, Jamie McKelvey, Francesca Cassavetti, Mark Ellaby, Christina Bashinsky, Tom Humberston and Sean Azapardi. And the exhibition opens at 7 p.m. on Friday the 23rd of September. Another exhibition that's currently on is the Orbital Comics Self-Portrait Show. This includes work also by Adam Cadwell, Christina Bashinsky and Tom Humberston, as well as Dan Berry, David Hine, Edward Ross, Ellen Lindner, Gary Leach, Joe DeSee, Luke Pearson, Mark Stafford, Rufus Daiglow, Shaky Kane, and many more. The exhibition is on at Orbital Comics, 8 Great Newport Street, near Leicester Square Tube, and runs until October. And if you're thinking of popping into Orbital Comics, a good time to do so is Saturday the 24th of September, when from 3 to 4 p.m, Rebecca Isaacs, the artist of the new Angel and Faith Buffy spin-off comic published by Dark Horse, is doing her first international appearance. On next week's show, which is the final episode of Panel Borders broadcast in its traditional slot of 5 p.m. on a Thursday, I'm talking to graphic novelist David B. about his new book Black Paths. Following that, Panel Borders moves to Sunday evenings at 8 p.m. and the first guest in the new iteration of the show will be comic book creator and DJ Kid Koala. To find out more about all my forthcoming shows and to check out my archive of all the previous podcasts, please go to www.panelborders.wordpress.com. Panel Borders was recorded by Alan Morrow on behalf of the Imperial War Museum and was introduced and edited by Alex Fitch. Thanks for listening.